Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment.
You may be seated. Good morning. Our first case is 12-2110, City Mortgage Incorporated successor versus James Rosnowski et al. For the appellant, Mr. Wallace.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is David Wallace, and I represent City Mortgage in this appeal. I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal, please. The two certified questions before this court present important issues.
Counsel, would you pull the microphone a little closer?
Yes, of course. The two certified questions before this court present important issues relating to foreclosure judgments. For some 50 years, Ohio courts have recognized the judgment decrees in foreclosure that award a money judgment, decide lien priority, and order a sale of property satisfy the requirements of RC 2505.02b1 and therefore are final appealable orders. This is true even if the judgment decree in foreclosure awards judgment for the amount of constantly changing costs relating to interest, taxes, court costs, and property-related expenses, but does not specifically itemize those amounts in the judgment. To require the premature itemization of those types of costs will result in inaccuracy and inefficiency. The best time to itemize them and to ensure they are correct and accurate is not in the judgment decree and foreclosure itself, but rather when the foreclosure sale is confirmed. This approach is consistent with longstanding Ohio law regarding what constitutes a final judgment. It adopts a sensible approach that has been endorsed by a majority of the courts of appeal in Ohio, and adequately allows for and protects the borrower's right to redeem. The court should answer both certified questions before today.
Counsel, let me ask you a question. I'm over on your right here. I know it's hard. The Court of Appeals seemed troubled by the idea that the expenses were the inspections, appraisal, preservation, and maintenance. Weren't those all a fixed sum at that point, at the time of the judgment?
They were fixed at the time of the judgment, but they were fixed only from the perspective of the costs that had actually been incurred. Additional costs may be incurred after the judgment for inspections or property preservation. An insurance amount might be required because the insurance policy premium would come due. So yes, some of those costs had been incurred already at the time of the judgment, but it is very likely, if not probable, if not certain, that additional costs would be incurred in the future.
Well, I guess what the Court of Appeals was troubled by, and I'm troubled by this morning, is why wouldn't you just fix the cost, and if there's additional costs later before the sheriff's sale, then you go back to the court after the final entry, say, I need some more money.
Well, the problem with that is there's two issues with that, Your Honor. First of all, the judgment doesn't need to be final. The judgment isn't final if those amounts are not included in the judgment. So it really doesn't make any difference in terms of the finality of the judgment, which is what the Fifth District was concerned about. In addition, those amounts are changing. So the fact that they're placed in the judgment means as soon as they're placed in the judgment, they are going to be inaccurate and incorrect. They're going to have to be changed. And one of the issues that we have raised in the appeal is one of the inefficient aspects of that procedure, which the Fifth District would require, is that the judgments are going to always need to be amended. They're always going to be adjusted. They are never correct. You're always going to be chasing your
tail
on that.
That's standard operating procedure when it comes to foreclosures and sales.
Yes, that is standard operating procedure.
Why all of a sudden do you think the Fifth District has decided to approach it this way?
That's a great question, and I don't really know the answer to that. I can't really put my head inside the Fifth District's mind. I don't mean to be flip about that. It's not clear to me why it would be required. As I said before, it doesn't have anything to do with whether the judgment is final. Those costs are changing. So it seems to be an inefficient and unnecessary step that the Fifth District was talking about. Although I will say this, Your Honor, one of the things that the court did seem to be concerned about was whether those amounts might be able to be tested in some way. In other words, if there was some issue with them, whether they were excessive or whether they were unreasonable, something like that.
Well, I think, Counsel, I think honestly the Fifth District was, I think, more concerned with the impediment to the right of redemption.
Yes.
In the sense the Fifth District was saying, wait a minute, this homeowner has a right to redeem their property in, say, 3 days. And if you, as the bank, are saying, and I want money, but I don't know how much, is that a final judgment?
Yeah, the judgment is final. And the key point here is that the judgment amount is not related in any direct way to the redemption amount. The redemption amount is a statutorily created right that borrowers have, and it provides that in all circumstances, the borrower can come in after judgment and before confirmation, and confirmation is the time then when the borrower is going to lose their legal interest in the property. So prior to that happening, the borrower has a statutory right to come in and deposit with the court the amount that's required to redeem. But the amount that's required to redeem is not the judgment amount. The amount that's required to redeem is the statutory amount. Now, the statutory amount does go back to the judgment saying, okay, you have to pay the amount of the judgment, but the redemption amount is also including a poundage requirement. It also includes an amount for a deposit on, interest on the deposit that the purchaser of the sale would have made. So there are more components to the redemption amount than the judgment amount. So although there's some sort of relationship between those two numbers, they are not the same.
But counsel, you've said that even though there's a relationship, you've also said, but it includes the judgment amount. So at the time of redemption, how would a homeowner know what to pay under those circumstances?
The homeowner knows what to pay by asking the taxing authority how much the taxes are, because taxes will have continued to accrue from the time of the judgment until the time of redemption. The borrower would have to go to the clerk and ask what the costs were at that time. And then the borrower would also go back to the lender and essentially get a payoff statement from the lender. How much accrued interest has accrued since both the judgment and since the default? How much insurance advances have been made? How much tax advances have been made by the borrower?
All of the things that you've mentioned there are not, those don't particularly concern me because I think those are discernible. What about things like appraisal costs, inspections, the things that the lender might have some discretion over? How would those amounts be determined? Would that also be subject to the redemption amount?
Those amounts are discernible in the same way that the costs that the taxing authority would have or the clerk would have. You ask the entity that knows what those costs are.
Which is the lender.
It would be the lender.
But in some circumstances, aren't those costs disputed? My concern is something more like a lender that charges far too much for inspections or, you know, for upkeep of the property. What do we do with those kinds of costs where there might be a dispute about them?
Those types of costs, in our view, can be dealt with at the confirmation proceeding. It is the confirmation proceeding that determines what the distributions will be to the individual entities that are entitled to distribution.
But not at redemption, though. Isn't that a problem? How does the redemption amount become a fixed amount for the owner to redeem their property if the lender and the owner are squabbling over the more flexible cost, such as the ones that Justice French just mentioned? If there's a dispute that you didn't really spend all this money to upkeep this property or to inspect the property or in some instances to maintain.
If there is such a dispute, and I have frankly yet to see one in the cases that I've handled, but if there would be one, it would be able to be handled by the trial judge during the confirmation proceedings themselves, if it became an issue. The trial court under the confirmation statute has broad discretion to stay the confirmation proceeding for any reason that the court deems appropriate. So if this issue arose and it became a serious issue, that these costs were excessive or unreasonable, then the court could get to the bottom of that as part of the confirmation proceeding. But it
after there's an attempt at redemption?
During that process, yes, or after it, yes.
Okay, well, I mean, I'm thinking there's a legitimate buyer that comes in and bids on the property at the sale.
Okay.
And then the property owner decides that they want to redeem the property, and they have 3 days to do that, right? Yet
yes,
there's a dispute as to these flexible costs, the inspection, the maintenance, that sort of stuff. And me, so you're saying everything could be put on hold for the court to figure that out at that time? Is
yes.
that what you're, okay, and meanwhile, the good faith bidders, these people who have entered into the sale, thinking that they're going to have only at most 3 days to wait before they're going to be able to, you know, proceed with the rest of the process to get this property.
Well, the purchaser is the purchaser of the sale, frankly, is in an inferior position to the borrower. The borrower's right to redemption is more important than the buyer at the sale. The buyer at the sale is protected because they get interest paid on their deposit. So if the deal falls through, then they get paid interest. But that's a policy decision the legislature made by giving the borrowers the right to redemption. But as a practical matter, this is not going to be a major issue. There is no evidence in this record, and I haven't seen any evidence in the cases that I've seen, that lenders are using the contractual right to recover back property-related expenses to somehow pad their judgments to get extra money. As a practical matter, in today's economy, most loans are underwater. And that means that the lender is unlikely to recover the principal and the interest back, let alone these additional costs that are
expensive. So I guess that's why we're here today, though, because this is a big deal to somebody. And I guess my problem is, following up on the chief's question, you got a homeowner who says, oh my gosh, I'm in big trouble, I owe $100,000 on the mortgage, there's a judgment, there's a bona fide purchaser about to buy my house. The reality is they're going to have to go to a bank very quickly and find some money. And I think what the Fifth District is saying, they have a right to know how much they have to get to close the deal. And it's going to be $100,000 plus, and they can't go to a bank and say, I want $100,000 plus. They're going to say, what's it going to take to redeem this property? And isn't that what the Fifth District was saying? Until you put a finite number on it, it's not a final judgment.
Well, again, the right to redemption is separate and apart from the judgment. The judgment is final
Fully understand.
The judgment, under Ohio law, judgment is final. To answer the question about the finality, the judgment is final as long as it determines the action. And by determining the action, that means that the court doesn't contemplate any further issues regard to what was settled in the judgment. And that's certainly true with the foreclosure judgment. Once the judge enters that foreclosure judgment, judge is done. Now, if an issue does arise at confirmation, the statutory procedure provides that the judge can step into that and resolve these issues if there is one. 9 times out of 10, 99 times out of 100, there isn't going to be an issue on this. And the borrower is going to find out what the redemption amount is, and the way they always find out what the redemption amount is, if they are able to do that. They ask the taxing authority, they ask the clerk, and they ask the lender for what the amounts are that need to be paid. And if the borrower gets that number and says, wow, this number is a lot bigger than I thought it would be, gee, the property preservation costs seem high, he can negotiate that with the lender. He can go to the court and get some sort of resolution of that, but it is not going to be a major issue in today's economy.
So would there be a possibility of a second appeal then, in your view?
Absolutely. If the amounts are required to be itemized in the initial foreclosure judgment, the next day those amounts are out of date. Interest is accrued, taxes have accrued, et cetera.
In your experience, has that ever happened? Do you have multiple appeals in any of these cases that you're involved in?
I've seen multiple appeals here and there, but typically you have one appeal from the judgment, decree, and foreclosure. Everything gets wrapped up right there.
If I understand the first certified question, it indicates that the question for us is whether the judgment decree is final if it includes, as the part of the recoverable damages, the amounts for these inspections and the appraisals, but not specifically itemized.
That's correct.
So how does the judgment incorporate those, but not itemize them?
The judgment just says that the court hereby awards, as part of the judgment here and as part of the damage, the amounts of taxes, the amounts of insurance payments, the amounts of the cost and the amount of
property
preservation.
So you agree that that needs to be specified in the final judgment, but not the dollar amount?
That is correct. It needs to be specified as a category of damages that or costs that are changing constantly. As long as they're in there as a category, that sufficiently covers it, and then they can be itemized down the road.
And how readily is it available to one who wants to redeem to get those kinds of numbers from a lender?
Let me tell you this,
Sometimes
Justice.
You call up and you're talking to a computer for a half an hour before you can actually
First
get
of all, in most cases, there's going to be an attorney involved in the foreclosure process. So there is
Well, that
attorney.
Complicates it beyond the realm that we're already in.
Well, if they're dealing with me, I like to think that I smooth things out. But yes, it can be. But there is an attorney involved. You can get through to the right person. Believe me, if you're a borrower that comes into a lender and says, I would like to pay the entire amount of the judgment, the entire principal, interest, taxes and all the property preservation amounts, I'd like to pay that today, and I'd like to get my property back. There isn't a lender in the state of Ohio or across this country that wouldn't jump the opportunity to do that. I would like to take a few, I think my time is just about up. I would like to reserve a few minutes or seconds for rebuttal if
Thank
I can.
Thank you. Mr. Traska.
Good morning, Madam Chief Justice. May it please the court. My name is Peter Traska. It has been my privilege to represent the Rosnowski family in this foreclosure action brought by City Mortgage. This Ohio is a judicial foreclosure state, which means that the right to foreclose and to execute on the home derives from first getting a legal monetary judgment against the defending homeowner. That's where this case has bogged down and has come before this court, because the question is how much information has to be in that final judgment entry in order for it to be deemed a final appealable order. I would submit that a foreclosure case is no different in this regard than any other type of civil case. And I'd further submit the City Mortgage is asking for a special rule for foreclosing banks as to the degree of definiteness that must be present in an entry in order for it to fix the rights of the parties. That's
Counsel, if what opposing counsel says is that categories need to be identified, but not amounts because they're moving targets, so to speak, why is that not sufficient?
Because the great majority of those amounts are fixed as of the time of the judgment entry, the first judgment entry that would be the order for foreclosure of the equitable room and to execute on the property. At that point, there is a great deal about that judgment entry that can be known, and there
can
is-
Can or can't?
That can, and that is known. The amounts of the back taxes, advances for insurance, whatever has been expended for inspections or property protection, what has been done to that point, the cake is baked there. What follows after that point is generally a much smaller amount. I actually think that the primary argument here is that it's just a matter of the integrity of judgment entries. You know, in an injury case, for example, I wouldn't write an entry that incorporates prejudgment interest unless I calculated the interest. I think that's the only fair thing to do, is to reduce what I can calculate to, you know, as of the time that the entry is going to hit the docket. For, you know, and with prejudgment interest, as the amicus chimed in with certain statutes that provide for statutory attorney fees, you very frequently have the problem that some of those costs are going to continue to accrue after the first entry of judgment. That doesn't mean that you don't make the initial judgment as complete as you possibly can. It's just a matter
counsel,
of-
Counsel, your opposing counsel proposes that in the 3 days you have to stop the sheriff's sale from going forward, you can call the bank and they'll help you out there.
Your Honor, it's beyond the scope of the narrow issue that's here, but as you can tell from the brief, I included enough history to let you know that my clients are skeptical. They've gotten disparate information from the bank before. There's a track record of that. Now, that's an issue specific to this case, but it is also an issue that's capable of repetition.
But they have, on the certified question before this court, they say, well, just give us a number and we'll break it down later.
That's right. And I think that that's a rule to allow execution on the family's home under those circumstances prejudices any family who does want to exercise the right of redemption. We've heard Mr. Wallace for City Mortgage concede that the right of redemption is not, the amount of redemption is not co-equal with the amount of the judgment entry, but the judgment entry is the largest part of what the redemption amount is going to be. I think it's also a disservice to allow for a greater amount of review for anyone who might be interested in purchasing a property at a foreclosure sale. It would be a damaging announcement from this court if the rule in Ohio now were that the judgment entry is not going to be reviewed line by line until after the property is already sold. I would think that would drive down the price, and I would think that City Mortgage has as much to lose from that happening as anybody. So the Ambrose case, which it's this court's case from 1990, speaks to the dual nature of the two judgment entries that are involved in foreclosure, and it picks up a lot of the older case law, which all points to the conclusion that the first judgment entry is supposed to resolve as many issues as it possibly can. It is supposed to fix the rights of the party. In any civil case, that means answering the question, what do I owe you? I don't think that that's possible to get out of through City Mortgage. So the Ambrose case further clarifies that the standard of review for the hearing and for the proceedings that happen in the trial court on just confirmation, the standard of review for confirmation has always been abuse of discretion. So this is an issue I haven't heard addressed either in the briefs or today by City Mortgage. To relegate the review of every sum that went into the judgment entry to a proceeding where the governing case law says the only review available at that time is abuse of discretion, that's a pretty scary outcome for homeowners. And I just submit that it's not consistent with the case law.
Counsel, were your clients in the position to redeem this property?
No, I don't believe so, Your Honor, but the statutory right remains open until...
They didn't, in other words, it wasn't a situation where they attempted to redeem the property.
There has been no attempt to redeem to this point.
Okay, correct. And they were in default, and there was no dispute of that. I was looking through the record earlier to see whether there was an actual attempt, and they were thwarted, as you said, that they had got misinformation from the bank on prior occasions or numbers they couldn't count on, but in reviewing it, they did not make an attempt to redeem this property.
That is correct.
Have you ascertained what the costs are with respect to the inspection and the taxes and the rest of that from the bank and the other taxing authorities here?
Justice O'Donnell, I would submit that ascertaining, I have not ascertained that amount.
Okay.
I don't think it's that obscure to ascertain the tax amount. I have to concede that that's... The 11th District Novastar case says, well, the better practice would be, you know that amount is at the date of the entry, put it in there. That's the better practice. But I have to concede that that's not so obtuse. That's a matter of public record that's relatively reliable and accessible. The issues that I think, and here I'm in different space than the Court of Appeals on this, the Court of Appeals said, and I think mistakenly, that insurance premiums are themselves ascertainable. I don't have any idea how that would be. That has actually, in this case, been paid by City Mortgage. And that's one of those things that can be paid at an inflated rate when it's the bank that goes with a forced placement insurer. That's usually not as good of a deal as doing the insurance yourself. So I part company with the Court of Appeals on that issue. The Court of Appeals was also silent as to the cost of the action. I don't know what those might be yet. I don't know if the City Mortgage...
Well, the certified question helps us a bit because the question certified to us for resolution is whether or not the amounts advanced by the mortgagee for inspections, appraisals, property production, and maintenance, but are not specifically itemized.
That's right.
So have you obtained those amounts or made efforts to obtain what those amounts were on behalf of your clients?
No.
Okay.
I can't say that, no.
We have not. Counsel, would this case be different if we didn't have 54B language?
No, Your Honor, it wouldn't be. And I think Walburn versus Dunlop is the most recent final appealable order case to issue from this court. Walburn says that the issue of whether the entry is definite enough precedes even Rule 54B. I was looking at this in terms of the Oberlin case. Hypothetically, if you had a contest about whose lien goes first, it would be my position that the 54B language is operative on that issue. But to say that Rule 54B never turns an indefinite order into one that is final and appealable, if it is voidable for indefiniteness. To come back to Justice O'Connor's question, have my clients attempted to exercise the right of redemption? There's not much on this record because the case has been out of the trial court for a long time, so the record is fixed, but that's a right that remains very much alive. Obviously, for parties, as Justice O'Neill said, it's a big deal to someone. So whether or not my clients want to exercise that right, in the first place, that right remains very much intact until 3 days post the confirmation of any eventual sheriff sale. And in the second place, it's obviously a larger issue than just to my clients.
But the costs are continuing to accrue on this property, are they not?
That's correct.
The maintenance, the insurance, the taxes?
The maintenance, the insurance, the taxes, yes. And they're continuing to accrue, but it's not mysterious at what schedule they are continuing to accrue.
Wait a second. The maintenance, what happens if there's, you know, some property damage there and there has to be a roof leak fixed or, you know, there's some thievery and the, you know, infrastructure of the home is damaged. There are a lot of variables there.
There potentially are variables. Sure, maintenance is something that can't be known. And certainly, to a degree, the judgment entry has to remain open-ended as to what you can't know about the future. What we're saying is that it's unlikely. Those are exceptional circumstances that Your Honor mentioned. To the degree that the judgment entry can be made definite, that's the standard. If I could submit one rule, that's it.
So, I mean, that is not as nailed down or concrete as what you were initially up here arguing for.
I don't follow, Your Honor. I'm sorry.
Well, I mean, you admit there's variables here.
Well, yes, that's right.
And there's open-ended costs. And there are going to be unanswered costs that are going to be, have to be, I don't know, buttoned down as to the date that you're going to tender the dollar amounts on behalf, the borrower is going to tender the dollar amounts to redeem the property.
I would submit, I don't think this is an inconsistent position because it's, in the first place, you look at what has happened, what is actually done as of the date of the first entry. Step two is to say in that entry as much as you can say about the way that future costs are going to accrue. Some catch-all language saying, I don't think anyone would have a straight-faced argument that if a tree falls on the house subsequent to the order for foreclosure, obviously there are maintenance costs that are necessary to do there. But that's, you know, the general rule of how definite the entry should be shouldn't hinge on that exceptional case where the tree falls on the house. In the great majority of cases, the expenses that continue to accrue will be the taxes, will be the insurance, inspections, which happened at a scheduled time and are, you know, relatively minor expense. Maintenance is certainly somewhat open-ended, but you know, I'm sure the city mortgage has good averages for what it takes to maintain a house. I know that winterization is a big issue, but you know, they know what that costs. So for the vast majority of cases, it isn't unworkable to say the bank is beholden to put as much information as can reasonably be known. And that's what I wrote. It's obviously they can't nail down everything. It's not a rule that they have a crystal ball.
So if I'm understanding your argument and relating it back to the first certified question, you don't object to a journal entry that says that there's a judgment for the taxes that will be due. That category is fine as far as you're concerned.
Yes, Your Honor.
You're just objecting to a category that says amounts advanced by the mortgagee for inspections, appraisals, and property protection and maintenance?
Let me add insurance to that list.
Okay. So some of them, in your view, can be categorical, and others must be specified.
Yes.
And you want us to write the decision of this case that says these have to be specified, And these have to be categorical.
Yes, that is the
and
certified.
But for that, there's no final judgment in your view.
That's correct, Your Honor.
I think yes. I understand your argument. Thank you, Mr. Draska.
But counsel, why aren't your concerns about these indefinite costs fixed, as your opponent says, or I guess I should say your friend on the other side says, at the confirmation hearing?
Mr. Wallace has been a friend, I will say that. Because the right of redemption is one very significant problem. Leaving that right that indefinite is not a good formula for anybody who does want to exercise that right. Secondly, the abuse of discretion review that I would beg this court, if we lose on the first proposition of law, please, Ohio homeowners need an announcement that this is de novo review that would happen down the road. I don't think that's the correct outcome, but that's one of the frightening outcomes for me, is that the case law right now says you only review for an abuse of discretion. That's not the time for judicial oversight. It comes back to what I think is primary. It's a judicial foreclosure state. The right to execute on the home is secondary. It's an outgrowth. It derives from the fact that a legal judgment has already been assessed. The legal judgment is comprised of a dollar amount. Some portions of that dollar amount can't be known at the time of the judgment, but the vast majority of it can. The largest sums can.
So for you, it doesn't really matter whether there's a confirmation hearing or not. You think that there needs to be a final judgment with the items that you specified, and I get the dialogue between you and Justice O'Donnell. There are certain things that should be specified. So for you, it doesn't really matter. Nothing can be fixed at a confirmation hearing because that comes after what you think should be the final judgment.
I would agree with that rendering.
And yes. You would object to the idea of having two possibilities of appeal?
That's right, Your Honor. I see I'm out of time, but to answer Your Honor's question, yes, I don't think it's workable to push the issue of what are the amounts in controversy down the road to that. Every other issue, and if you look at the brief in the Court of Appeals, there were four assigned errors that haven't happened yet. This case is either going back to the trial court or it's going to the Court of Appeals to decide those other issues. The amount of the judgment entry, I think, is even more basic than the issues that are already in the Court of Appeals. It doesn't make any sense under the two-step process, in my view, that arguing over those amounts should be reserved to the confirmation hearing.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Wallace, you've used your time.
If I might have just a few moments of rebuttal, Your Honor.
Go ahead.
Thank you. I think Justice O'Donnell's question hit the nail on the head, and that is that the proposal that the Fifth District has adopted and that the appellees are proposing creates inconsistent and creates categories that are inconsistent. All these amounts are changing, and yet they demand that only some be in the judgment, but others are okay. But the key point here is what makes a judgment final. What makes a judgment a good judgment that has res judicata effect down the road? And that is whether the judgment determines the action. And that's why the courts of appeal that have looked at this have looked at whether the amounts are ascertainable by the borrower without judicial intervention. If they're ascertainable by the borrower by asking the lender or asking the clerk or asking the taxing authority, the court doesn't have to get involved in that.
That makes the judgment final. One last question, if I
yes.
may, then. I'm agreeing with you on the categories. I guess I'm also wondering why the Fifth District is such a hard order to comply with. If they're just saying on the day of judgment, X, Y, and Z are awarded to the bank in this dollar amount. What's difficult about that?
It's not difficult. I think by local rule or by some other judicial rule, I think courts could probably require that. I think Cuyahoga County and—
What about this court?
This court has to worry about whether it is creating a standard for finality of judgments that's inconsistent with longstanding Ohio law. And by adopting a rule that says that a judgment is not final, even though there's no additional judicial activity that needs to be done, and even though the judgment awards by category amounts that are changing,
well, what if it
I
just
think
says,
it's a problem.
What if a judgment just says, this is what is owed in these three categories today? Isn't that a final entry?
That judgment could be final, yes, as long as there was no judicial action that needed to be taken from that. And the judgment could still be final if it said, these are the amounts known today, and the court awards amounts in the future as well. That still makes the judgment final. What the Fifth District is saying, if you put language in that amounts in the future are also included, under the Fifth District standard, that judgment isn't final. And that means that we keep chasing our tail with regard to the finality of judgments. And that's what this court should decide.
So,
this
counsel, what I hear you saying is that it's not difficult to comply with the known amounts owed as of a certain date for the lender.
Your Honor, I certainly could not say that at the time. Let me answer your question this way. Certainly when the affiant signs the affidavit that says these are the costs that have been incurred to date, that amount can be definite. But of course, as soon as that affidavit is filed, there may be another cost that occurs the next day. There may be another cost that occurs the following day.
What kind of cost are you talking about?
Well, interest is accruing on a daily basis.
Okay, and you know what the interest rate is, and that can be built into the judgment without any issue whatsoever.
Sure, there
you
might...
You know what the taxes amount to per diem.
Right, by asking the taxing authority and asking the
yes,
the clerk.
So those
yes.
are known quantities.
Well, they are knowable quantities once they're requested, and the same is true of the lender's
you're
information.
You're saying that it's not the lender's view or responsibility to put that into the judgment, it's the borrower at the time of the attempted redemption to get those amounts, that's where the burden lies.
That's correct. If the borrower would like to redeem the property, then the borrower needs to ask the appropriate entities to collect the information that's necessary to meet the statutory requirements for redemption. That is on the borrower, not on the lender, because as soon as the judgment is entered, those numbers are going to be out of date.
So the judgment entry has to capture the category in the entry to be final and appealable. And there may be a ministerial point in the future to actually determine what that amount is.
That's correct. Okay. And it would be a ministerial action either by the clerk or actually an action that the court has no involvement in at all, because the borrower gets it and submits the amount that's required to redeem and deposits that with the clerk, or however the local rule for redemption is set forth. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement, gentlemen. You'll be notified of our decision. Thank you.